This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So, my name is Shiv Kodak, and we're SNP. What we're all about and our mission is to make podcasts more relevant and more profitable. When we looked at the media industry, what we saw was billions and billions of dollars are going to the media industry this year. And there's an explosion in content. Content can't be created fast enough. But when we looked at podcasting, what we saw an audience size of 48 million listeners listening to 6.5 hours a week. Let's compare that to, say, Netflix. Netflix has 98 million people who watch podcast, 98 million people that watch video for 11 hours a week. Now, Netflix has twice the audience size and twice the attention. But given how much money is spent in content, only $30 million was spent in the full podcasting industry compared to $6 billion in Netflix. 200 times more is getting spent by just one company compared to the full industry. Why is that? The big reason is there's only apps out there. There's no platform. And because there's no platform, it's hard to monetize content properly. And without a platform, it makes it very, very difficult to have even money going in to make content. Let us tell you how we know that. And first of all, what needs to happen in order to make podcasting the next billion-dollar industry? Now, we spoke with this community. We spoke with Kelly. Kelly is a podcast listener. She's also a journalist. And she loves listening to podcasts. She loves learning new things. She wants to share relevant content. She wants to share and brand her, like build a brand, build her relevance, build her authority, and build her credibility. Not only that, she wants a platform and tools to help her enable her to do all that. We also have Alex. He's a podcast producer. He wants to know his audience. He wants more people to get exposed to his podcast. And at the same time, he loves podcasting, but it would be nice if he can make some money from it. We spoke with this community. We did over 120 interviews, and we heard them. And what we heard was podcasting apps are outdated. As a listener, it's hard to discover podcasts. It's hard to share podcasts, and it's hard to engage with others who listen. Now, listeners have a problem, but so do podcast producers. Podcast producers are out of touch. They have a hard time getting analytics, who my users are, what are they listening to, and how long are they listening to it. And really, they have a hard time connecting with their audience. You can have all of your podcast listeners go like a Facebook page, then what? Really, as a listener, you need a better experience, and a podcast producer, you need help connecting with your users and monetizing your content properly. That's where SNP comes in. With the SNP platform, you can listen to all 500,000 podcasts out there for free. You hear something interesting, hear something memorable. Great, create that moment, pull that moment out of the podcast. And you can save these moments or share them in the newsfeed. You can follow your friends. What are they up to? You can also follow thought leaders. Every time you come to our platform, you find something new or interesting. Now, you can send these SNPs in external messaging, in iMessage, Facebook, or Twitter. These SNPs are playable in those tools themselves. Your audience or your recipient does not have to download our app to listen to the SNP, because each SNP is a trailer to get new listeners to listen to this podcast. This platform is your home. You have your whole history and all of your SNPs here. And based on this, we customize and personalize this platform to you through the discovery feature. Think about it just like Netflix, showing you content in the right way. Check out this small trailer. If you like it, great, go check out the episode. If you like the episode, great, go check out the show. Now, it's the type of experience you will be the first one as a listener to share relevant content. You'll be also the first one to build your credibility, your authority, and a following. It's the type of experience that people will switch their apps for, but through our user testing we found out, it's the type of experience that people will stick with. This is how we differentiate. We have a variety of features that we found through market interviews as well as user testing. Below the line, all the features that podcast producers want. We have all of them on our platform, and that's how we differentiate from the big guys like Apple or some of the small ones that really just don't cut it. SNP is the right product with the right features. Let me tell you why right now is the right time. In the podcasting industry, the New York Times The Daily Podcast had 200 million downloads just last year. Not only that, other news media companies are seeing this, and they're launching their own podcast in quarter three of 2018. Now a big wave of content is coming, and SNP will be ready for that. Not only is there a ton of content, but also a lot of users. 48 million people listen to podcasts on a weekly basis for 6.5 hours a week. but 224 million smartphone owners out there. This can be bigger, but because of a lack of a platform, it makes it really difficult. And this lack of a platform means this whole industry is struggling. Annual revenues per user in the podcasting space is only $3 a user. Here's the thing, though. This problem has existed in other media spaces. Now, we're talking about, for example, Facebook. Facebook figured it out. $27 is the annual revenue per user. And when we look at the amount of ad spend, $207 million was spent in the full podcasting industry compared to $40 billion by Facebook. Snip will be the Facebook for podcasting. And this is how we make our money. We first of all charge podcast producers and advertisers for Snip analytics. Who are your listeners are? What are they listening to? How far are they listening? What are they snipping? You also have Snip Survey. Think about it as SurveyMonkey in audio form. Give us a clip, we'll test it out for you, give you statistical data on the type of traction this podcast will have. We also have Snip Ads. It's audio ads, 15-second or 30-second ads. And then Snip Payment. Pay 25 cents or 50 cents to access content early or access exclusive content. And this platform is high growth. In 3 years, we look to reach $13 million, and when we expand globally, that's really when the scale takes into effect. Snip will be the industry standard for listener experience, analytics, and really will make podcasting profitable just like the other content spaces out there. Now, here's how we go to the market. We have a couple monthly target goals. 1,000 users, phase one, 10,000 users, phase two, and phase three, 40,000 users. We launch in 2 weeks our alpha product that has been for a user group that has already been selected. In 6 weeks, we launch our beta product with two podcasting partners to target users, specific users to chart our application. And then in August, we launch our full product. And really what we're trying to do when we launch to the public is create a flywheel effect. We'll first of all target users through Facebook associated with our podcasting partners. We go after journalists that promote podcasting tools, and we also go to podcast producer events in order to promote our platform and our tools. We also partner with podcast producers in order to create that flywheel effect. Not only is it by having more listeners on our platform, we can provide better analytics, and that makes it much better for podcast producers to refer users to our platform. We'll be bootstrapping it till the end of beta, and we're looking to raise a seed round of $800,000 to fund the next 18 months of runway. Let me tell you why we're the right team. We have experience, we have years of experience in product management, director level experience in software companies, in marketing, sales, and business partnerships. We also have some of us that have worked for companies like Microsoft on consumer mobile applications for 10 plus years, such as Skype or MileIQ. Others who have done design work for Fortune 500 companies. And lastly, we also have the expertise to go after, or to use machine learning and voice technology to target and personalize this platform to you. What we're really building is a platform for searching for new ideas, to share different viewpoints, and to share information. So many different opinions out there today, and we want to learn. We want to hear each other, and we want to be understood and understand. Think about how much better we all would be if we all were better informed. Think about the impact. Snip is a way to learn. Snip is a way to make podcasts more relevant and make them more profitable. And just maybe, it's a way to bring us all back together. Thank you.
Nice job, Shiv. Okay, would any one of you like to begin? Are you not on? Can we turn these mics on over on the table? Is there a button to push?
Yeah. Oh, there we go.
There you go.
You mentioned four different revenue streams. Sometimes I see that when it's like, oh, I'm not sure which one of these is going to work out. Which one of those do you think is going to be the biggest, and which one would you start with?
So those will be actually two different revenue streams. The first money comes in through analytics, and that's really what producers are looking for right now. In the long run, it will be an advertising platform. And so year one, the biggest revenue stretch is going to be coming from analytics and the survey, which is, again, analytics. But year five, the biggest portion is going to be ads.
Can I ask you a little follow-up question there?
So
paying for analytics, you're already saying the podcasters aren't making much money. So how are they going to pay for analytics if they have little revenue today?
So the biggest reason is because podcast producers get asked for analytics by their advertisers. And one of the biggest hurdles they have as advertisers come to them and say, who is the audience I'm targeting through your podcast? And they're not able to answer that question. And that's why the amount of money they're making is much lower, because they can say, well, I'll just go to a platform that gives me analytics on who the users are. So.
Okay, thanks.
Stuart.
Thanks for your work and presentation. Well done. You know, an elephant can love you and still kill you. And as you're going into this market, you're relying on first mover status to win this race, right? What other barriers to entry are you erecting so that you cannot get crushed by your elephant friends up north?
So that's a great question. When we actually searched at this, we found out that if we create a network and an interlocking ecosystem of podcast producers to lock them into our system saying, here's the type of benefits you're getting, and you're already being able to connect with the users, that's really what the first mover advantage will help us establish a network, and that will be our moat, is the network of podcast producers.
But is that enough to stop a big player from coming in who owns a lot of content from essentially replicating your platform?
So are you asking companies such as maybe like Apple?
Could be Apple,
yeah.
Sure.
So actually, we had that question too, and we spoke with, why isn't Apple or Spotify or Google doing this? And the answer we got, first of all, was there's actually two parts. First of all, the majority of their resources, money, and time gets spent on operations and building these platforms and maintaining them. And secondly, it's actually too risky to modify a full platform that has millions of users on it, because you could alienate those users. And Snip takes a good amount of front-end as well as back-end infrastructure change. So essentially what Apple and Google and all these companies are doing, they're looking at startups to market validate a feature set, and they're acquiring those companies and integrate them in the future.
But if I'm investing, I've got to be sure that that elephant isn't going to crush you.
Mm-hmm. So again, the biggest answer to that is that they're not focused on this. Their R&D is mainly focused on acquisitions and investing in companies rather than building it internally themselves.
Then one other,
yeah.
Dave. In terms of your team, I see a lot of technical skill and technical leadership skill. Tell me a little about business development or sales.
Mm-hmm. So myself, I've had experience in a director level role doing business partnerships, mm-hmm. In terms of for sales in the software space. So that's where our business expertise is. And really, to be the first ones to market, we need that technical skill set at this point. Our expansion is going to be people that will do partnerships and sales. So that's the next steps in the hiring process.
Thank you.
Kathy?
Okay, so I'm trying to understand the value of having the platform with just a snippet on it, as opposed to helping me find ways to find the podcasts that I like. So for me, it's a bigger challenge to say, if I'm interested in a specific topic, where are the podcasts that talk about that topic? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then maybe a snippet might be a trailer that gets me to buy the movie. Mm-hmm. So can you talk more about, you know, how you've thought about that?
Yeah. So when you onboard onto our platform, if you're a podcast listener, there's two different use cases, a listener and a non-listener. If you're a listener, you'll be able to export your full library from, say, Apple Podcasts or one of these other apps through a file input into our platform. So we will already have certain types of categories associated with you, and we'll do recommendations that way. But if you're a non-listener, when you come onto our platform, we'll have you just show you a few trailers or a few snips and test out your likelihood of liking a certain topic or not. And really, that's how we'll configure it. So that would be the discovery feature.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
So we also will be building a wizard to onboard you in, where you will be given topics that you can select, and that will then use machine learning to figure out what more things that you might be interested in.
Okay. All right.
Josh?
Yeah, so
Two quick questions. One, I think you're really onto something with the analytics piece of this. Businesses need to understand what's going on, and clearly in this space they don't, it sounds like. So my first question is there a major player today or players that specialize in analytics for podcast producers, and have you connected with them and thought about, you know, doing a B2B to C approach to the analytics or business-to-business approach through a channel partner that exists already?
Yeah, so there's actually not the companies that do analytics, so we did interview them and we spoke with them. The companies that do analytics, what they only provide you analytics-wise is how often was an RSS feed link requested from what IP address. Because there's no companies that are integrated into the front end of a podcasting platform, so those types of analytics, so as an advertiser, all I can tell you as a podcast producer is your name was mentioned in some MP3 file that was downloaded X number of times by certain types of IP addresses from certain regions. Other than that, I can't tell you anything. Because I'm not integrated into the front-end client face, that is, you know, Apple Podcasts or Overcast, those are the front-end client faces. And they're, again, as I was saying, they're mainly focused on maintaining their service and maintaining their user base, because how they go after them and how they monetize that is through advertising.
Okay. And then my second question is, why not go give this away for free for 3 years and get everybody addicted to the analytics and the capability and the functionality, and then work your way into like a freemium kind of a model and work your way up?
Yeah, so that's exactly actually how we'll be approaching it. So there will be different tiers. So, you know, tier one, you'll just get free analytics on, you know, how many your users are, what does their distribution look like, and really the deeper analytics you get, and then you'll have to pay for the deeper analytics as well as industry averages and how do you stand in comparison to your competitors.
So it's free at first. You're not going to charge. Okay, got
it. Okay.
Any follow-up questions? We're good? All right. Thank you. Great job.
Hi, I'm Andrea, and this is my teammate Colette, and we are More Solar. Now, you may think of solar as a clean technology, but I'm here to tell you it's actually a pretty dirty business. So now we all know that if you leave anything outside for too long, it gets dirty. Be it your car, your dog, or your kids. Now the same effect happens to solar panels. Solar panels accumulate dust, and this reduces their total energy output. Now, in various parts of the United States and in numerous countries overseas, this effect called soiling is the biggest hurdle facing the adoption of solar power. Even the CEO of DEWA, Dubai Electricity and Water Authority, has said the effect of soiling is the biggest challenge facing solar panels. So what's causing this loss? Well, anytime you have a solar panel outside and it collects dust, there can be anywhere from a 3% to a 20% loss in the total energy output. And this loss is responsible for billions and billions of dollars in lost revenue every single year. And where solar panels fail, we continue to be reliant on fossil fuels. So how can we make solar panels efficient regardless of the environmental conditions? Well, we know dust doesn't simply teleport onto the surface of solar panels. It's carried by the wind. And what if we use the same wind that kicks up the dust to clean the solar panels? Well, that's exactly what we've done. We've created an economically viable wind-powered solar panel cleaning solution. Let me show you a video of our technology in action. Now, you're watching highly compressed dirt being removed by the simple action of the wind. But please keep in mind that the prototype you saw in the video was simply given as a proof of concept. And of course, if you were interested in investing, we could share more of our proprietary details. So here are the existing alternatives today. Currently, there's steam cleaning, sprinkler systems, robots, and good old manual labor. But it's all costing the industry significant amounts of money and precious resources like water. Now keep in mind, we're in an international water crisis. We don't have water to waste. Why use one precious resource to generate another? Let me tell you about the value in More Solar's product. More Solar doesn't use water or electricity. On top of that, our product takes mere seconds to install. And once it's installed, it's extremely low maintenance. But the best part of our technology is that it cleans continuously and completely. This means that solar modules will never experience losses due to soiling, ever. This is unlike any existing technologies on the market today. These novel features will make More Solar's product the most effective solution on the market. Now, my teammate Colette is going to explain more about our business and market strategy.
Thank you, Andrea. Now, the solar power industry is growing at a rate of 59%. And as that grows, so does the loss. Now, governments globally are now investing in renewable energy. In fact, Saudi Arabia, the oil capital of the world, has just committed to investing $109 billion for renewable energy alone. That's amazing. So let's look at the current market. Currently, there's 2.5 billion solar panels worldwide. 70% of those belong to utility, and that's our target market. Now, if we multiply that by our selling price, which is $2, that makes a market of $3.5 billion. And we're looking at the United States, 15% of all worldwide installations. That makes the market $525 million. That's pretty healthy. But how are we going to get into it? Well, first things first, let me talk about First Solar. Now, First Solar is the largest manufacturing and operator of solar panels worldwide. In fact, they manufacture so many solar panels, it can wrap around the Earth 6 times. And that's a stat you can find on their website. Now, First Solar has actually invited us to come to their testing site in Mesa, Arizona this summer to prove our product's performance. But before we can even get into that, we need to go into the refinement stage. In the refinement stage, we're going to be doing prototype evolution. We've currently already been doing this, but we're also going to be doing patent filing as well. That's really important before going into First Solar. At First Solar, we're going to be showing our product's performance and waiting on their qualification. This will move up into the scale-up phase. In the scale-up phase, once we actually receive that qualification, we'll then know we're commercially viable. We'll be making relationships overseas with manufacturers, and we'll be able to create our supply chain process. We'll then be investing in business development and small-scale installations. This will move nicely into our commercial phase, which we'll be doing our first large-scale solar panel utility plant in the United States. We'll then be launching a global marketing campaign, followed after by launching our product. Now let's go a little bit more into detail about our business model. The cost of goods that we're approximating is 50 cents. The price that we're trying to sell at and that we're estimating at will be $2. So let's look at a typical installation. A typical installation would be 3 million solar panels. Multiply that by our product price, that would be $6 million in revenue for More Solar. But for our customer, that's an additional $75 million in renewable energy that they get to keep. So if we look at the timeline, we're currently in the product refinement phase. We're going to need investments for materials in order to keep refining it. And then when we go to First Solar, we're going to be needing it for travel costs and to refine the product along with them. Going to the scale-up phase, we'll need investments so that way we can actually start investing in our business development and also engaging internationally. But we'll actually be making revenue with our small-scale installments. This will be maximized once we expand globally. Now, who created this great product? Great question. Let me tell you. Our team is highly enthusiastic, cross-disciplinary, from business to humanities to engineering. We've been guided by two advisors, one of which has 20 years of experience in the energy industry, the other, a serial entrepreneur, experience in patent execution. Now, during a time when the world is facing water crisis and climate change, we have created a product to allow additional renewable energy to allow this world to be a cleaner place. We are More Solar, and we turn your dust into dollars. Thank you.
Great job. Kathy, you want to start us off?
Oh, boy, I've got a lot of questions. So I'll just ask a few. Can everything be cleaned off the solar panel with the brushes? Is there anything that gets residue that gets left?
So our product uses a really durable material, and it creates friction between the material and the surface of the panel. And with enough friction, you can scrape pretty much anything that has been adhered to the surface of the panel.
Okay. Obviously, you're only in prototype stage, but have you thought about the production challenges of high-volume manufacturing?
Yes. So basically, the product that you saw in this video was a very preliminary prototype. It was just shown as a proof that this technology does indeed work. Our current technology, I can't disclose too much about it for IP reasons, but obviously, if you're willing to invest, we'd love to.
I love you guys. Somebody touch it that well. So one last question. How much wind is necessary to drive continuous production of the brushes and the airfoils?
So our material is very lightweight. It can be moved by a very small wind push. We estimate around 5 miles per hour of wind is enough to move our device. But keep in mind, in most arid regions where this product will be installed, the wind speeds get up to significantly greater than that.
Good.
Josh?
Yeah, so I'm going to ask two questions that are very, very different categories. So your slide that you just projected showed, I think it showed $25 million in 2021. Did I get that right?
You're talking about the revenue?
Sorry, I'm sorry, $5 million. I've got something here on my printout that's totally different. So this looks like a huge potential market and a huge business, and all your other slides are huge and gigantic and massive. But the revenue looks really small here. So what happens in 2022 and 2023?
So we have planned to scale at a very first. We are going to develop our product completely, testing our product. Then we're going to scale very fast on a global scale because the problem in the Middle East and North Africa is much larger. The loss is 30% to 40%. It's at the same time in India too. So we're going to grow really fast, but we have done this as a conservative estimate. So we're going to grow really faster than this. This is just a conservative estimate.
Okay. And then, again, just totally different question. So light, shiny objects, birds love them. So what keeps desert animals from attacking your product and using it to build nests?
So actually, right now, the operation and maintenance companies have problems with this already. Solar panels themselves are shiny and reflective, and they actually have to remove dead raccoons from some of the wiring from time to time when they chew up the electrical. Right now, it's not too big of an issue just because this is already happening there. Our material is very, very durable, and I can definitely disclose more of it for those who are willing to invest. I know I've said that a lot, but basically our material is very, very durable, and it should not have too much of an issue. It's supposed to last a very long time, and we estimate that we pretty much can guarantee that it won't have any issues.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, yeah, if a sheep eats it, sometimes they have sheep, like, grazing the grass there. We can't stop that. But it's fairly durable, and it's also very clear, so it's hard to see.
Yeah, I see. It's hard. So it's translucent.
It's very translucent.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Stuart?
Thanks for your presentation. And, Andrea, there's only one thing tougher than being an entrepreneur, and that's being a distance runner, so I think you've got that covered. What method of manufacturing are you looking at for this part? Is this injection molded, thermoform? What are you doing? And how many units do you have to make your projections? And how many does that take?
So I will take on that question. So basically, we are thinking of having injecting molding. So we are talking to manufacturers in China, Vietnam, and Malaysia about our prices for the mass manufacturing. In the year 2019 and 2020, we are starting with small-scale installations. So we are looking for 10% of one utility plant. And as we grow further, we would require millions of units. So once we set up a tie-up having with the manufacturer, we will have an order in bulk. So let's say 3 million panels. So our product is required for each panel, and we would require 3 million units for one utility plant.
And have you gone to any of the large plastic manufacturers, Dow Chemical, et cetera, DuPont, to partner with to develop this part?
As of now, as we are in the prototype development phase, we have tested our technology, going to visit to a site of a company, and we will test how it's going to have a commercial viability. Once we go through that process, then we will move on to that phase.
And one final question. If you're saving me $75 million, which you presented, and you're charging me $6 million, are you concerned that you're leaving too much revenue on the table? And have you thought about a licensing model or a I will give it to you for a percent of the savings model? And how have the utilities reacted to that model of revenue generation?
So we have thought about it because, like, this is a huge revenue that we are generating for these companies.
Right.
Can we just share it on a basis of, like, 30% of it and give the rest to the company? So we were looking at other competitors at what price they are selling their product. So we came up to a conclusion that we are providing additional, like, one value proposition, which is continuous cleaning, which does not exist in the industry. So we don't know much about, like, how that energy generation would be and how much that would be. So as we do more and more analysis and get the exact numbers, we're going to be getting in details on how much we can sell it more than this price.
Thank you.
Did you want to add to that, somebody, or are you guys good on that? I thought somebody was...
I was just going to add a little bit that $75 million isn't necessarily pocketed by them. It depends on how they sell the energy and whatnot, so it's not necessarily like they're just getting it, that $75 million straight out.
On top of that, price is always variable. When you go to talk to companies, right, we can negotiate deals with them. This is just a starting point for us. It was a reasonable number for us to get a basis upon how much our product's going to cost, how much gross margin we will have. It was just a starting point. Obviously, in the future, if we decide to go with a licensing model versus selling individual products, that's definitely an option. Again, we are in the product refinement stages of our product right now.
And something I forgot to actually mention is that $75 million is over a period of 5 years.
Oh. John?
Stuart asked my questions, but I would just say I think you should reconsider the licensing model, too, because it takes away a lot of the questions, like how durable is the product? I don't care if I'm a customer anymore because you're guaranteeing me that you're going to take care of the product. So I think that that's a really interesting, different approach. And I heard all your answers. I think they're great. Yeah.
I can just a little bit answer why we discarded that model over the selling model. So installation requires a lot of manual labor. So when they're going to install this product on, like, millions of panels, that will require manual labor. And that is a business that we have not decided whether we want to get into. As of now, there are operations and maintenance companies that basically manage the whole plant. They have their own people who take care of the plant.
So what is the cost of installation on top of your $2?
So when we talk about 50 cents, that includes the cost of our installation, which is 20 cents. We are considering about it takes 1 minute to install of a product at the rate of 13 minutes, $13 per hour of labor cost. It comes out to be 10 to 20 cents. That is the cost of installation.
Can it be installed as an OEM product at the place of manufacturing for the solar panel?
I did not get your question.
Could it be original equipment as part of a brand new solar panel?
So yeah, that actually there are two value propositions. One is to the existing utility plants. One is to the new utility plants. So when the new utility plants would come up, we're going to reach out to these manufacturers such as First Solar, and they will install our product directly along with the panel itself. That will not cause any extra installation cost.
Thank you, More Solar. Great job.
Hi, everyone. We are Okra Systems. We offer engineers a software tool to help them realize products faster. What do all these products have in common? They have one, or perhaps a few small computers embedded in them. These computers are known as microcontrollers. There's one in this remote control. There's a few on you right now if you're carrying a smartphone. Engineers are tasked with selecting, configuring, and qualifying these microcontrollers. These are tedious, time-consuming, and error-prone tasks. Errors and uneducated decisions in the early design stages can have a drastic effect on the product's release schedule. Errors can have a drastic effect on the product's release schedule. In a recent survey, over 1,000 embedded systems engineers reported 60% of projects they were designing were behind schedule. 35% of products were delayed by over a quarter. A quarter. We offer a tool that shortens the time to select, configure, and qualify microcontrollers by up to 75%, significantly reduce errors, and result in the selection of the least expensive microcontroller that meets requirements. By using our tools, companies can take their products faster to market, they can free up valuable engineering resources, and they can ultimately help their bottom line and increase their gross margin. There are over 12,000 different microcontrollers on the market today. Their price ranges from 24 cents to $55. A microcontroller's data sheet is 100 pages long. 100 pages. Imagine you wanted to buy a new car, and there were 12,000 new models out there on the market, and the brochure of a car was 100 pages long. How much time do you think that would take you? Engineers need to configure microcontrollers to perform functions that are related to the product that they're designing. To perform this task, engineers consult the reference manual. A reference manual is 1,500 pages long on average. The manufacturers provide tools to help engineers perform this task, but each tool has a unique interface, a unique workflow, so an engineer has to learn a new tool. Finally, engineers want to qualify microcontrollers for performance and responsiveness. They have to write multiple applications that perform exactly the same task because each microcontroller from a different manufacturer has a different software interface. Our tool addresses all of these problems, and let me tell you how we do this. We use artificial intelligence, and specifically natural language processing, to parse through thousands of pages of documentation. We extract semantic information, convert it into structured data, and store it in databases. Now, our cloud-based application comprises of a recommendation system, a specification matching algorithm, and a code generation engine. The recommendation system assists and guides the engineer when inputting requirements into the system. A specification matching algorithm matches these requirements against information that's stored in our database and returns a list of the least expensive microcontrollers that meet these requirements. Our code generation engine generates configuration files, and it also creates a uniform software interface so that engineers have to write one single application. Now, our users download our client-side application, they purchase a license, and then they connect to our cloud-based application to use it. This model gives us the competitive insulation we need to protect our IP, which are the algorithms and databases, because users do not have direct access to them. We estimate there are 500,000 embedded systems engineers worldwide. These are our users. At a global average license price of $5,000, our market size is about $2.5 billion. Initially, we want to target the US and European markets, where 65% of our users reside. We also assume initially perhaps one license is going to be shared among three engineers at a given site. That puts our go-to-market at 100,000 users. We generate revenue by selling annual licenses. These are incrementally added to the license. And we believe our users will annually renew them because 70% of products complete are designed within a year. And 65% of products need a new microcontroller. We calculated these prices during our market validation. They represent a portion of the engineering cost relative to the time each module saves. The fastest way to penetrate this market is through by reaching an agreement with one of the electronic components distributor that's mutually beneficial to us and to them. There are many of them, including DigiKey, Mouser, Newark, Arrow. Users usually frequent their sites because they have a large selection of microcontrollers. They can filter through them through a few very high-level criteria, sort them by price, and start looking at the data sheet. At this point, the engineer is trying to solve a complex permutation problem that's relatively easy to automate. We can release a free tool that solves this problem, ask one of these component distributors to feature it on their website. In return, we list their prices, and we drive traffic back to their website when engineers are ready to make a purchase, like buy a development kit. By doing this, we're able to slowly penetrate the market and build our user base. And if we release this selector light version, the free version, about a year before we release our selector and configurator modules, then we have to work on converting free licenses into paid licenses. We will be able to sell 7,500 licenses in our sixth year of operation. This will result in a $41 million revenue. We will start generating revenue in our second year. We will be profitable in our third year at a gross margin of 96%. We seek to raise $1 million to build our core team and market our free tool, and raise $1.5 million during the second year to be able to expand our team, add marketing, sales, and customer support, and also market the modules. I'm Joseph, and this is my colleague, Andres. We've been collaborating together for over 4 years now, and we created a new programming language called Stride and the complex code generation engine. It's a really exciting time for us to enter the embedded market with our tool, because today we are seeing growth in sales of microcontrollers because of the Internet of Things and the automotive industry, driverless cars. And we believe our tool can play a pivotal role in the design of new products in these two industries and many others. Thank you.
Nicely done. Josh, do you want to start us off?
Oh, I love this idea because there's nobody in this room that would try to go do what you guys are doing. That seems to be your defensive strategy. So two quick questions. One is, are IAR and ARM or Keel, are those competitors? They're in your notes, but not explicit as competitors.
They provide tools as well, but we think we feel a different niche because they do more code editing side, but we will work on more the initial design phases, right, where it's more of a manual work that the engineer does. So we don't consider them our competitors.
Okay. And then you talked about AI, building structured databases and so on. As we all know, that learning process can have flaws. You can load flaws into the structured database. Then you end up in critical systems. So is it really just comes down to Q&A at the point of the where the engineer is working with the device to prevent problems from happening?
No. Our idea is to have some engineers validate this. This is just a method to get that process done faster.
Got it.
But we definitely need an engineer verifying and okay. making sure
and
this
usually,
is
okay. And usually most of the information is already structured. It's a matter of like what kind of questions engineers ask. For example, how much current can I source? What can I do this? These are semantic information that we can extract. So, and help engineers have them available, readily available, instead of going through a 1,700-page document, for example.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Stuart?
Well, this is high cotton for a shoe dog, let me tell you. But I think of this as Harry Potter's sorting hat for microprocessors. So that's how I'm getting my head around it. But, you know, when you're doing this and you're putting this kind of input in, you've become a gatekeeper for microprocessors. So the number one thing that you have to sell me is trust. Because I can't believe anybody goes out there and says, I'm selling a really lousy microprocessor for too high a price. Choose mine. So is there really just one right answer to every question that comes up?
No, definitely not. What we will do is recommend a number of microcontrollers that will give you kind of a range in prices. And the reason why microcontrollers have such different price range is because not so much that they are cheap or they are worse than others, but it refers to the peripherals they support and what they can support simultaneously. So that's what Joseph meant by a permutation problem.
And so your distributors and the vendors of these microprocessors are going to have to trust you that the logarithm that you build in is going to give an accurate and truthful answer.
Yes, that's
right. And you think you can do that 100% of the time?
We think so, but we also hope we can enlist, once we have some traction, we can enlist their help so they can become partners and that we can work together to make sure this information is actually accurate because it's in both our benefit.
Thank you.
John?
That was a good presentation, by the way. One of the claims you made earlier on is that 60% of projects are behind schedule. That number seemed really low to me since I work in software. I thought hardware is harder than software. But how much of that is attributable to the microprocessor selection and just, you know, yeah. Software, we don't have microprocessors, and there's probably more than 60% of them behind schedule.
Yeah, naturally, not all of it. But we think that by choosing the right microcontroller, first you're reducing the time to select it, but also you're avoiding problems later because it's a common problem, and this we found through our market validation when we talk to engineers that do this, that they have projects where they chose a wrong one and they have to just go back to the drawing board, and this is often one of the reasons for the delay. It's not the only cause, but we can address delays in this way.
Okay. What about, you mentioned distributing a free tool. I would assume that the partners that you mentioned that produce microcontrollers have some selection type tool. How would you differentiate your tool from what they do already?
Right. The tools that are out there already help you kind of lay out the configuration of the microcontroller, but what they don't do is they don't help you to in a smart way, resolve issues, right? And you have to start by telling, I want to use this microcontroller, and then you start configuring it. Right, rather than the other way around. With our process, you start saying what you need in it, and then you will be told which microcontroller can do the job. And also, each manufacturer has a different tool. And this is one of the reasons why engineers are kind of locked into manufacturers, because learning the different workflow is so hard and so time-consuming. So they often go maybe not with the best product, but the one they know.
A couple more questions, I guess. One thing you mentioned is you had a licensing model, and then you just assumed that people were going to break that licensing model and share licenses. Why not have some different model that actually works better for your users?
Well, this number of 1 in 3, we got it partly because companies will try to save, but also to try to break up engineering teams and the number of engineers from a team that will actually be actively using this tool. Right? So to these engineering groups are maybe 14, 15, 16 people, and we think maybe 4 or 5 would be involved in this initial phase. So this is where we kind of think the sharing comes in.
We've also thought about a second licensing scheme probably, but we need to do the market validation to see like how the tool is going to be used, which is sell a company a base license and then add seats as modules, because it might be that like the electrical engineer wants to use like the selector and then the hardware engineer wants to use the configurator or something like this.
So there are different ways like to, into organizing like this structure. But this would be like the simplest one for people to understand and for us to manage. But there are other ways to do it.
Okay. The last one I had is, and it sounds like you guys have done some significant work here, but code generation is like a really difficult problem that's been around. And I mean, I wish that I could auto-generate all the code that we produce. And obviously, you've done some work around that. It sounds like an even more difficult problem because everyone's got a different interface. And I would assume if there's 12,000 microcontrollers, there's thousands of new ones coming out every so often or revs of them. And so how do you solve... Can you tell a little bit more about how you really solved that problem?
No, that's very true. But this relates to the research that we've been doing here at UCSB on our Stride programming language, which is a high-level specification language that then code generates. And we have kind of proof-of-concept code of how it could be done in a cross-platform way, targeting both embedded systems and desktop platforms. So we have some headway in that area, and we've really thought about the problem.
Yeah. Kathy, I know you're dying to ask a technical question.
I was just going to defer to my esteemed colleagues here because this is more than tall cotton for me. But being a CEO who never had a project delivered on time, anything you guys can do to help that out, I'm all for.
Is 96% gross margin defensible? I mean, I love it as an investor, but you might be putting a pretty big target on your north end.
So if we consider like the $8,000, right, yeah. 96%, like the 4% would put us at $320, which is the amount of server time that we need to give a user. And this is another tool that's going to be used the whole time. It's like they enter information, and then after a while, they get feedback. So this $320 will go like to customer support and just the server time. So if we can scale properly and we have smart algorithms that do not require too much traffic, then we can do it.
We have time for one more if you have one follow-up. Nope, we're all set. Great job, guys.
Thank you.
Hi, we're Adomi, and we help homeowners monetize their largest asset. So I think we can all agree that homeowners these days have a lot of financial concerns. Take Sarah and Tyler, for example. They're a recently married couple who just purchased their first home in Los Angeles. And even though they both work full-time jobs, they find it tough to get ahead. The mortgage is a burden. They have other family members to take care of. And on top of all this, it makes it seem like retirement is never going to be an option for them. Through the grapevine, they heard about this amazing new concept of accessory dwelling units, which are secondary housing units that you can place in your own backyard and rent for income. Not only are ADUs financially beneficial for homeowners, they're great for the state of California, as Governor Jerry Brown and his team have stated that ADUs could be the potential solution to the housing shortage that we are all currently facing. Sarah and Tyler were elated at the idea of having this beautiful revenue-generating unit right in their backyard. They thought, wow, this sounds great. We put down a few thousand dollars, build this ADU, and in a few months, we'll be making money. But wait, let's be realistic. Construction is not for everyone. It's messy. If Sarah and Tyler were to undergo the traditional build process, this is what 2 months of progress would look like. Sarah and Tyler would have put down $50,000 just to take care of design, permit, and framing, and then their contractors would have to tell them that it's going to cost another $100,000 to finish this process. What Sarah and Tyler would not have realized is that this process is complicated. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. On top of all these factors, they have to deal with permitting, taking care of the city planning department's rules. Then you have to work with managing the actual property. Then you have construction crews coming in and out, which inevitably leads to noise. Then you have contractors also coming in and out. And then you have inspectors giving you hassle, telling you that now there's going to be delays. This whole process leaves homeowners feeling stressed, anxious, exhausted. Homeowners like Sarah and Tyler are wishing there's a better way. There has to be a better way. Fortunately, there is. I'd like to introduce you to Adomi, where we replace all the stress, all the hassle, with peace of mind. We are the one-stop-shop brokerage firm that takes care of the entire ADU process at absolutely no cost to the homeowner. And here's how it works. First, we pre-screen the property to ensure that ADU eligibility, or the property is eligible for ADU construction. We then work with our standard blueprints to design and work with city planning departments to ensure that the permitting process goes smoothly. We then build the ADU in a prefab manufacturing facility, off-site from the home, to ensure that we limit the amount of time, hassle, and noise that actually occurs on the client's property. After that, we install the finished product seamlessly in the homeowner's backyard. During this entire process, we are working with established property management firms to ensure that we have a queue of qualified tenants to place in the ADU. And after the ADU is installed on day one, we're able to place a tenant in there. This entire process, from eligibility to property management, takes less than 90 days with Adomi, cutting traditional build time by more than half. Not only are we able to substantially cut build time, we're able to offer homeowners $11,000 a year at absolutely no cost, no stress, no anxiety to them. The way Adomi makes money is by sharing in the remaining portion of rental revenue with our investors and ourselves. Now I'm going to pass it off to Solik to tell you why right now is the perfect time for Adomi to execute its business model.
Ryan is absolutely correct. Right now is the perfect time for us to penetrate the accessory dwelling unit market. California is facing a housing shortage. In fact, California ranks dead last in housing production per capita. On top of that, 33% of income is being spent on mortgage. And over the past 5 years, income has stayed the exact same while mortgage continues to rise. These two market trends couple with our market size of $160 million. This is composed of 20,000 units in San Francisco and Los Angeles alone. As we expand, we hope to go to other parts of California and at some point, the nation. This is how we plan on getting there. In August of 2017, our focus was on the proof of concept and really understanding the pain points involved with ADUs. In January of 2018, we began market validation, composing of over 100 customer interviews, including architects, homeowners, construction workers, and real estate agents. From May 2018 into the summer, we will be incubating our business idea, bootstrapping $25,000, and really focusing on web development and the legalities. In September of 2018 into the next year, we will be doing an initial 5-location test in California, focusing on being as efficient as possible with our ADU development. This will require $250,000 of capital. The way we plan on going to market is through Airbnb hosts, as these individuals are incredibly comfortable with home sharing. We're confident that we can help them further maximize their real estate value. Our revenue projection by year 5 is $27 million, and from year 1 to year 2, we will need $800,000 of equity raise. In order to reach our $27 million goal, we will need to vertically integrate and take different parts of the supply chain, which includes having our own property management firm, as well as our own prefab manufacturing facility. We also have the exact team to bring this product to the market, starting off with Vahan Gazarian. He built an accessory dwelling unit in his parents' backyard the hard way. He had to deal with the permitting, the design, the build, all by himself, and his terrible time serves as the inspiration for why we want to create a better experience for homeowners. With Vahan, myself, Tomi, and Ryan, we have expertise in sales, marketing, design, and real estate valuation. We also have an external team that have expertise in business operations, real estate brokerage, and on-site analysis. We haven't been able to get here on our own. We've had incredible help with a mentor called Brian Coriat. He's a part of the Santa Barbara Angel Alliance, and he's been instrumental. He's had 25 years of experience as a successful entrepreneur, and he's really helped us tailor our business model to be attractive to investors. On the architectural side, we've had help from Suzette Naylor, who's part of Thompson Naylor Architects. Their focus is on having green architectural designs and being environmentally conscious. With her help, we're very excited to bring that green, environmentally conscious mentality into our accessory dwelling units. Let's take it back to the story, Sarah and Tyler. What if they had used Adomi from the start? Well, instead of being $50,000 in debt, they would have had an accessory dwelling unit in their backyard generating income for them so that they could focus on what really matters: mortgage, retirement, and taking care of their family members. Adomi today is a real estate brokerage firm, but in the future, we plan on taking the entire supply chain and providing homeowners accessory dwelling units in under 6 weeks. If there's one thing I can leave you all with today, is that Adomi, in all of its endeavors, consistently strives to build peace of mind. Thank you.
Let's work, guys. Josh, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so I love this idea. I had many different angles that are great about this. Congratulations. It's very well researched, and I like how organized and complete your financials look and your projections. I'm not sure if you are, but I'm going to just ask, why do you want to be in the landlord-tenant management business? Because it's typically like a nightmare, and there's huge unexpected costs, and it's distracting, and can you explain that to me?
Yes, we'd love to explain that to you. Tommy, would you like to take that question?
Of course. Thanks, Vahan. Thank you for asking. So the reason we want to get into this business actually is, in the beginning, we're going to have asset managers who will manage the leases, so we won't directly be handling that. Later down the line, throughout the process, we will then move into that space as we are able to really take hold of the business.
I see. So it's not the initial plan to deal with a tenant complaining about a chicken in the backyard and, okay.
No, sir.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. I'm also a fan of this idea, and I'm very, very familiar with modulars and ADUs. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions. Let's start with one similar to his. Why do you want to be in the manufacturing business, the prefab manufacturing business?
That's a great question. So the manufacturing business today, we would have a partner that we would be contracting with. So we would have a part of their capacity, because after speaking to a few of them, we understand they're not operating at full capacity. And so going into the future, once we have collected enough data and understood the process ourselves and how to make it better, we hope we can then move into that space to capture a larger margin or part of that supply chain.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you that Hallcrest and Silvercrest and Hallmark and Cavco right now would hire you guys as marketing agents to create a market for them, because that is exactly what they're looking for, is they don't know how to do the front end of it. So I would encourage you to think about partnerships that already exist that would put you in the market today. And so then the other question I had about your model, if I understand it, you're going to get real estate sponsors and investors to help finance these units, and then the owners are going to use this as a money-making thing. So let's say right now I'm not making very much money and I need that money-making thing. But, hey, I get older and I make more money and I go, I don't need that money-making thing anymore. How do I get out of the deal?
I'm glad you asked. So the homeowner, over the course of the 25 years, has the option to buy the ADU at any point in time. At the end of the 25 years, the ADU is theirs to keep. Now, the way we factor this buyout is given to the homeowner at day one, so they know at any point in time throughout the period at what cost to them it'll be.
So it's just like a mortgage with payoff.
Exactly.
Okay.
John?
I love the idea of Airbnb starting there. I think that's a great idea. It sounds like you talked to a lot of homeowners in your market validation. What else did you learn from them about who likes ADUs, who doesn't like ADUs?
Sure. So thank you for that question. So over the course of the past 6 months, we've conducted over 200 market interviews. So from what we learned from homeowners, the biggest thing that we learned is that they actually love the idea of accessory dwelling units. With Airbnb, we know that homeowners are comfortable with the sharing economy, at least the ones on Airbnb. But the biggest reason they can't do accessory dwelling units right now is because they can't pay for it. So with our creative financial model, we found a way to bring accessory dwelling units to homeowners at scale. Did that answer your question, or I could clarify?
Yeah, that's great. What about, you know, I guess one risk you have potentially is legislative risk, right? Someone could, you know, Jerry Brown could get not get elected next term, and someone could decide they don't like ADUs, and there's a better solution. Obviously, there's a huge societal problem that it's solving, so that's a great thing, but how do you as an investor, how would I, you know, justify that risk?
I'd love to answer that question, John. So today, the political climate is very pro-ADU, with Governor Jerry Brown, with California and the state as a whole. If in the rare circumstance that was supposed to change in the future, we hope by that period we would have established ourselves and executed our business plan in the areas that we're looking to execute as we penetrate the market. And by that time, we hope we would have the capital to kind of reintegrate ourselves as we capture different parts of the supply chain, as we mentioned before, to kind of move into and be a little more flexible of a company.
I guess last question. That was great. Thanks. That was a great answer. Last question. You didn't talk too much about competitors and defensible. It seems like, you know, obviously there's lots of manufactured home suppliers out there. How do you feel you have a moat that's defensible?
So we have two types of competitors. One that exists today. Their name is Dweller. The difference between us and Dweller is that they're operating out of the Portland, Oregon area. After speaking to one of their executives, they're only looking to move into parts of Wisconsin and kind of expanding into parts of Oregon. So their market is not necessarily California. As of today, they've only done two ADUs. On the other side, when we look at large real estate, commercial real estate developers, their business models are more focused on, you know, one large building that has multiple units, not really scaling into the residential space. And so we hope that in the time that we have as a first mover in California and Los Angeles and San Francisco, that would give us a big advantage to execute our model.
So kind of brand, you're hoping to build a brand that would
definitely
be defensible.
Stuart?
You know, I want to put on my short skirt and pom-poms and cheer because I like this idea, but this looks like, I mean, the difficulty of extracting value looks like a bear trap laced ATM. So, I mean, you spent the first time talking about the complexity. This is very complex.
Definitely.
You've got to deal with banks financing. You have to deal with contractors, the local government in every municipality, and renters. I mean, that's the trifecta of I mean, I don't know what hell looks like, but that. So how do you navigate that? I mean, you know, just take our city, Santa Barbara, Goleta, Montecito.
Absolutely.
And how do you navigate that?
So I'd love to answer that question. I think it's a two-part question.
I would love for you too.
That then I think Tomi can jump into a little more of the financials. We're not necessarily reinventing the wheel. We're taking two successful business models. One was Solar City's home appreciation model, and the other being the REIT model with large single-family management. So we're taking two models that have proven to work in the past and combining both of them. And Tomi will explain how the finances kind of... I hope that answers your question in the first part, but...
Well, but you still have to deal with every municipality has to approve these dwellings, right?
Right. So because we're working with manufacturing facilities, city municipality inspectors are not the ones inspecting us on in the sites. It's actually state inspectors. So as long as we follow the codes determined by the municipalities, the state would approve us in one space.
Yeah, but Mabel next door doesn't want me to have a house next door.
So the nice thing about California really making it entirely legal for the state is that this is something that the government is pulling for. In fact, Los Angeles as a city has spent money in developing accessory dwelling units. upward of like $15 to $20 million. And we want to work with community members, not against. We're really confident that because we're building in a prefab manufacturing facility, really decreasing the amount of noise that comes with it, being able to ship it there, it's really ultimately a kit. So because we're using prefab technology, the construction process becomes a lot easier for the contractors as well.
So when you sell the home, what happens to the dwelling, to the second, third owner?
Yeah, so when the home is sold, similar to the depreciation model that we mentioned earlier, we will take back the money that is owed to us at that point in time on sale. The ADU has appreciated the value of the home, so there will be the value there, the difference. Now, if the homeowner doesn't want to pay us out, they can negotiate with the new buyer to continue on with the lease.
But it's not an obligation of the new buyer to take it on?
No.
Okay, so you're just going to wrap the mortgage is what you're really going to do. Because when they come in and do a new appraisal for the property that the ADU is on, the appraiser is going to appraise the entire property. They're going to put a new mortgage on. It just wraps the mortgages, and it does pay them off, Stuart, I think.
Exactly.
One thing you are missing, though, in your answer is that even though modular units are built to a standard that here in California most of the municipalities are forced to accept, you still have to deal with the permitting in every jurisdiction. And so that is going to turn you into planners, you know, to help the homeowner.
And therefore, I'd say what your team is missing is a legal team. My fifth favorite thing.
With that, we're out of time. So great job, Adomi.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremiah Tan, and I'm here to show you how Soylight can provide energy for the earth from the earth. As we all know, there's a growing need for renewable energy resources in our world today. And we believe that Soylight can be one of those new sources by applying a unique technology that not a lot of people know about. Here's what it looks like. Our solution, or rather, our Soylution, is a soil-based energy resource. And we do this by utilizing microbial fuel cell technology, which allows us to generate electricity directly from the microbes that are naturally present in the ground. So how exactly does that work? Well, first, let's take a look at a standard battery, which has three main components: an anode, a cathode, and an electrolyte. When connected to a circuit, chemical reactions create a buildup of excess electrons in the anode, which are then later displaced in the cathode. The flow of electrons from anode to cathode generates electricity that you can use to power a variety of devices. Microbial fuel cell technology is similar, except we're using the microbes and the soil as an electrolyte. So just like how you and me would eat food for energy, the microbes would take in nutrients from their surroundings and release the excess in the form of electrons. Now, this technology has been tested and proven before. But in previous applications, such as undersea and wastewater treatment, microbial fuel cells required specific conditions just for the technology to work. But what we're doing is that we're optimizing the technology itself so that it works in a new environment, soil. Because our product is aimed at microbes in ground soil, the probe materials and cells are designed specifically for that application. And we strongly believe that the uniqueness of this design would warrant patent protection. So, needless to say, there are many potential applications for this technology. And while our main goal is to one day light the world, we're starting with your garden. So at this point, you're probably asking yourself, Jeremiah, if there's so much potential for this technology, why start with garden lights? Well, if you really think about it, every success story has a beginning. And after extensive market research, totaling over 100 potential customer interviews, we found that our best initial market fit at our current stage of development is in outdoor garden lights. These interviews confirmed that there's a highly lucrative market for us to take advantage of while we continue to work towards our ultimate goal. Additionally, current products in the market have gaps in their performance that we can immediately address and fill. So our product is a soil-powered light that is both effective and efficient, a new lighting solution for your outdoor lighting needs. What we have is a technology that is weather-independent, So it works in locations that don't get sunlight, for example. It's consistent and continuous because we wanted to design a product that can work whenever you need it to. And of course, it's sustainable. The U.S. landscape lighting market is massive, with over 41 million projects per year, which equates to an annual market value of about $6 billion. And of that $6 billion, we plan on targeting a $240 million market for related landscape lighting applications. Additionally, the uniqueness of soil light gives us the opportunity to capitalize on a market of about 20% of that for locations that get little to no exposure to sunlight. Within this market, we have three main customer segments. First, those who value sustainability and genuinely care about the environment. Second, customers who are not fully satisfied or have issues with current products today, like solar lights. And third, those who can't even use solar for some locations, such as shaded areas. Now, we plan on selling our product through various channels, and the first of which is through commercial distributors of garden and lighting products, as well as landscape installation companies, because it's efficient and will allow us to sell in volume. We also want to sell directly to the public online for a variety of reasons. Not only is it relatively fast and easy to set up, it's lower cost and will help our marketing efforts to build brand awareness. In the future, knowing that this technology has many potential applications, we see that there are huge opportunities for us to license it beyond our own product development. In terms of manufacturing, we're estimating the cost to be around $3 each, which is only about a dollar more compared to related products. And we're planning on selling at an average consumer price of about $10 per unit. Here's how soil light stands out against current products in the market today. There's no additional electricity costs because we're completely off-grid. It's easy to install because we learned that customers want to just set it and forget it. And again, it's continuous because it works in areas and conditions that other products can't. You see, our product capitalizes on the limitations of these alternatives and show exactly why soil light can greatly supplement current products such as solar and wired lighting that are available in the market today. Moving forward, we've laid out a plan that accounts for our goals, our milestones, and our funding requirements. For the next year, our main focus is on developing the product and the technology. During this stage, we're going to file a provisional patent and seek $750,000 in funding so that we can further develop our product as well as scale our efforts by hiring engineers. After development, we're going to file a utility patent and proceed with a second round of funding so that we can begin building inventory and start selling through the aforementioned channels. And after going to market, our next level is in expanding our product line, which includes developing other applications such as phone charging or even powering homes without electricity in the future. We have a team that can make this happen. One with diverse backgrounds that will help us overcome any obstacle we may face as a company. We have a hardworking group of TMP students focused on the marketing and business aspect of soil light. A strong technical team who specializes in a variety of fields, including chemistry, biology, and electrical engineering. And of course, a great group of mentors who have helped us get to where we are today. Lastly, meet our founder and inspiration, Jillian Nguyen. She was born and raised in Saigon, Vietnam, where electricity went out most days of the week. She's told us stories of how her family relied on burning kerosene just to have enough light for everyday tasks. And for those of you who don't know, a light source like this is not only costly, but it can also be extremely harmful to a person's health and the environment. Now, take a moment to imagine yourself in her shoes, living in a world where there's no power and access to electricity is uncertain. It's pretty rough, right? So you see, the issue is that Jillian is only one of the many people who's experienced this problem firsthand. In fact, having lived in the Philippines for the first half of my life, I vividly remember blackouts that would last for days on end. Today, over 1 billion people around the world still lack access to a consistent source of electricity. And as we all know, energy is one of the most pressing needs for a developing society to succeed. Now, this problem is being addressed by solar, but solar still has many, many limitations. Julian's struggles motivated her to study hard so that she can one day solve this problem. And in turn, she's inspired us, making us passionate about our vision of one day taking this technology to developing countries, where there's not only an abundance of soil, but also a large unmet need for energy. So, while we may be lighting your garden today, tomorrow, we're going to energize the world. Thank you.
Next presentation. Stuart, you want to start us off?
Yeah, one inspiring story. Makes me proud of the people who come to this country. Everything works for me in this presentation except one thing. I don't know whether your light works. And, you know, there's a difference between theory and reality, and I've got to know that that light bulb goes on enough that Jillian can read the book or study with it, or that it's comparable to an electric light in my garden.
You guys want to raise those up over your head so everybody can see them?
What's the wattage there?
Yeah, what's the wattage?
We're doing 5.5 volts at a 75 milliamp current, so that's around 400 milliwatts.
And how does that compare with your average garden light?
So at the low end, they're doing between 1.5 watts to 2 watts. So with R&D, since we've grown a lot in the last couple months, we went from in the tens of milliwatts to where we are right now in the last couple months. We're confident that with further R&D, we'll be able to hit that mark.
So if I sit in a closet, I can read a book with that light?
If we get the lights off, maybe.
Okay. And does it work in the frozen tundra of central Nebraska in wintertime?
So the current only limitation that we have with this technology is all you need is for the soil to be properly moisturized. So as long as there's water content in the soil, it creates enough, it conducts electricity enough to power the light.
Thank you.
John?
Yeah, wow. It seems like really amazing. Have you guys done any patent search yet or any patent-related work?
We've been drafting up a provisional patent, and we're hoping to issue it within a month. Hopefully we can take advantage of the free one if we win the competition. So that's what we're looking for.
I had some of the similar questions about where it works and where it doesn't work. It sounds so. I guess what one thing I heard you say just to verify is like it won't work in the desert.
Actually, it will. It does. It still functions as a measure of how much water capacity it is, but it still will generate energy. So if we scale it to a level where it's powering much higher applications in like regular soil, sand will work too. Is it this one? This one's running off of sand from the beach. So,
Kathy?
Okay. I'm concerned about your margin. Okay. A $10 price point, when you add in it, when you take a look at the difference between MSRP and wholesale, so what you're going to have to sell it to Osh and your landscape architects and all of that for, and allow for your marketing, your distribution, your administrative costs and stuff, I don't think your price point's high enough. How does your price point compare to some of the solar lights that are in the market today? Other alternatives?
We're a little bit more expensive on the low end. That price up there that we had earlier, the $10, is an average price point. So selling through the website directly, we'll be doing $15. But through distributors, we'll be doing around $7 to $8.
Okay, so
it's an average.
Okay, so you are planning on allowing for the manufacturing costs. Okay.
Yes.
And once you get this down, I think that there are a lot of commercial markets where you can make money. Have you considered like being a B Corp where you could then take and work with NGOs and others around where making money off of here, we can send them to the countries that can't afford to buy them?
Yeah, we've looked into that. We know the process is really complicated, so we wanted to focus on getting a bit of revenue started first as a proof of concept.
Agreed.
And then we did call Unite to Light. We've been in contact with some organizations, but we really want to get a commercial product out first.
Agreed. Okay. Thank you.
So congratulations on getting this far. Clearly, it looks like it works here. I believe that it works. It sounds unbelievable. So I guess my question is, why weren't these lights in Home Depot 10 years ago? What's the barrier?
Okay, so this technology has actually been studied since before the 80s. And what they've been doing in prior research is optimizing the conditions of the microbes in the soil, just making sure that the microbes can generate as much energy as possible. So what we're doing is optimizing the technology itself. So the different materials we're using for the anode cathode, harvesting of that energy and storage. And we're trying to use that to make it so that it can be used in any soil and not just in the specified conditions that they have before.
I see. So you're saying no one's focused on this end of the problem.
Right, exactly.
Got it.
We've got time for a couple more.
I guess if I were a coach today, I would kind of go back to the theme that if you're going to sell me a light, I want to see something. And, you know, I think you're targeting the right market with the garden market. I know it's a problem. I've tried to do it. Solar doesn't work because the lights don't look like lights. And, you know, that's my concern here. And as an investor, again, I want to put on my short skirt and pom-pom and cheer because I think it's great. But you got to prove to me, and I would say to raise money, you got to show me that this is a light.
Mm-hmm. So we're planning on using the next 6 months after we issue that provisional patent to scale up the development. And it's been about the same time that we've been working on it before this, getting from around 40 milliwatts to 400.
Yeah.
And as soon as we hit the mark that we want to get at that 1.5 to 2 watts to sell on the low end for path lighting, we're going to try to get some traction using Kickstarter and other resources to show that this is a product that people are going to buy.
Yeah, just to kind of add on to that. So our main focus right now is definitely on the technology end. So right now we're trying to find a way to optimize the technology so that we can increase the power output. But once we get to the level that Ryan mentioned, that's when we're going to start like drafting up like actual designs, because we do plan on like making this look like a light. This is essentially going to be like what the base is going to be like. So you can just imagine like an actual light sticking out from the top, except it's not going to have like a solar panel in it. Everything that generates electricity is directly from the bottom.
There's also that when you're working with solar panels, you can only get this flat surface area. It's entirely as a function of surface area.
Mm-hmm.
So because we don't have the tools to do that right now, and no equipment, no lab, we can actually go, you know, an extra degree. We can go down. We can go deeper. That accesses a lot more soil, and that's all resources that we have access to. We just need to get funding for R&D so that we can get there.
Any others? Looks like we're all set. Great job, SoilBite.
A software company designed to help scientists spend less time searching and more time researching. Many of us envision research laboratories as pristine environments, very clean and organized, complete with alphabetized chemical shelves and so on. Unfortunately, that is not typically the case. Research is inherently a bit hectic. As a stem cell biologist myself, I see this problem firsthand day after day. We're stuck digging through massive freezers, looking for patient samples and other reagents, or in the back of cabinets and on top chemical shelves trying to find what we need. This wastes a lot of time, and it allows things to run out before we can reorder them or expire without ever being used at all. I first realized how truly frustrating this problem can be when I got the unique opportunity to interact with patients. I was attending a fundraising event for our research laboratory, and I met an individual who has the blindness disease that I study, retinitis pigmentosa. And in that moment, my research became more real to me than it had ever been before. It wasn't just about the time wasted looking for these reagents or the reagents themselves being wasted. This isn't a problem that just affects a company's bottom line. This affects the millions of patients who are relying on scientists and waiting for that next discovery. Our mission at Veneta is to improve life science research by streamlining inventory management, improving compliance, and creating more sustainable laboratories. When we were talking to our customers, we realized that on average, scientists spend about 15% of their time just managing their inventories and trying to find what they need. That's 6 to 7 hours every single week that each of those scientists could be doing productive research. And in terms of the reagents, there was one lab we spoke with that had $70,000 worth of a particular reagent. 25% of that had been duplicate ordered, and 50% had already expired. When we think about that time wasted in terms of the salary of the individual scientists and the value of those expired reagents, we've figured out that a company with about 50 employees is wasting $600,000 a year because of this problem. And due to this very hectic environment that we work in, a lot of things come in without barcodes or without RFID tags. And that means traditional approaches to inventory management simply don't work in this environment. Because of that, we offer a service with three unique values for our customers. First, optical character recognition. Second, spend and use analytics. And finally, improved compliance. We figured out that the biggest hurdle to proper inventory management is that scientists still have to manually input everything into a spreadsheet, and they have no mobile access. We offer image-based recognition using optical characters to scan invoices and reagent labels. Second, we want to help laboratories understand what they're spending money on and when they're going to run out of reagents. This is a huge problem in research. And by providing spend analytics and also experimental planning to track usage, we can help labs avoid running out of money or running out of reagents at very critical time points. And finally, of all the clinical trials that unfortunately fail, about half of them fail because the science just isn't quite there yet. But the other half fail because of issues to do with safety and compliance. By providing proper chemical storage information and other safety documentation, we can help labs follow all the FDA regulations that are laid out for them. Our software is intuitive. It was made by researchers for researchers. From the home page, a user simply snaps a photo of a reagent as it comes into lab. The pertinent information is extracted, and they can select a customized location from a drop-down menu or a call-out on a map. Our business model is a simple subscription for a software license. We've validated our price of $50 per user per month for both lab researchers and lab managers. There are 12,000 life science companies in the US. We plan to first focus in California on small to medium-sized companies, especially in the areas of San Diego and San Francisco. Our market of $2.7 billion is expected to grow, as in just since 2016, there have been 468 new life science companies in California alone. So why hasn't anyone tried to offer this service? Well, they have, but they've failed in two major ways. The first is that they've done nothing to get rid of manual entry. And as we know from talking to our customers, they simply don't have time for this process, and small to medium-sized companies can't afford to bring someone on full-time to do this administrative work. And second, they only offer a fraction of the features necessary to validate the cost of a software subscription. We've been developing and designing our user experience for the last several months, and with an initial investment of $250,000, we'll be able to complete development and launch in 1 year in California, expecting an annual revenue of $2.7 million at the end of year two, and launching then into the US at large with an annual revenue of $22 million at the end of year three. Our team consists of myself, Jerome Santos, and Will Summers. Together, we have 20 years of experience working in research laboratories and know this problem firsthand better than most. And we are all certified in technology management. Our wonderful mentors include Brian Coriat, who has extensive experience in software as a service and helped develop our technical value proposition. And Steve Shotwell, who has years of experience working with inventory management systems. Together, we are all very excited to have your support in our mission to make life science research more efficient. Not just because it's the best way to improve a company's bottom line, but because there are millions of patients, just like the one that I met, who are waiting for the next discovery. Thank you.
John, want to start us off?
Sure. I have the same problem in my kitchen. Can you solve that problem, too?
Yeah, it's on. Yes. We can hear you. Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, any industry that has consumables could conceivably work with this software platform.
Okay. I have some serious questions, too. So I guess a lot of this relies on optical OCR and recognizing labels, and that's actually a problem I know something about. It's imperfect, and so you're not going to solve that problem 100% for people. Have you guys done any work there to figure out what, you know, how much recognition you can actually do? I don't work in a lab, but I would assume labels are different, where they put different measurements are different on there, and what about that problem?
Yeah, we've tested that, and luckily with labels, because you're not dealing with issues of handwriting or anything that's actual image-based, and it's all printed text and generally easy to read printed text, in the samples that we've tested and used with just an open source OCR app, they do in fact extract the information we would need for the labs.
Oh, with really high reliability, so...
I mean, that's what we'd be developing over the next year, is testing a variety of products.
Okay.
I would add that one of our sort of major funding requirements is really to develop the back end further so we can really make sure that we improve that reliability.
Okay, good. What about, you said that some of the other providers don't have fully featured products, and you know, how do you explain that? Sometimes it's because there's not enough of a market there, or it's not a big enough problem for the customer you're selling to. Why do you think they don't have more fully featured products?
In our interviews, we've discovered that it's just not a well-understood problem, and it hasn't been approached correctly. They've tried to put traditional inventory management in an untraditional setting.
Okay. I guess last question. One problem I would imagine that you have, you kind of talked about scanning things as they come in, but everyone's got an existing inventory, maybe a very large inventory. How do you deal with that problem?
Sure. So 50% of the labs we interviewed actually just use an Excel spreadsheet. And so you can easily integrate what they already have into our system through typical means. Yep. As long as you have a spreadsheet.
Jenny?
Okay. It may be a size thing here, but in most of the medical device situations that I've been in, and my husband was with a major drug development firm, they can't operate without having their research labs, inventories, and, you know, everything totally connected to the rest of their ERP system. So how have you looked at integrating this and the FDA compliance you're going to need for your software?
You want to take the first part of that? I'll take the FDA part.
Sure. So can you repeat just the first part of your question there? How do we integrate this?
I'm concerned that most companies have other systems that you have to interface with, that the research lab doesn't exist in isolation, except in the very smallest early stage companies. Okay,
right.
And even they have to have the traceability for FDA, which means you have to go through the process of getting your software certified, you know, and they're approved by the FDA, and then being able to integrate with the other systems that the company's using. So two questions, the integration with other systems.
All right, so I'll handle the integration.
Okay.
So at least as far as we've done with our customer validation, we found that most, either the university or some of the small industries here in Santa Barbara, have an upstream procurement system where they actually can receive their chemicals or their reagents, and we're actually going to act as a downstream, right? And so many of these, like Jaeger, ERM, have open APIs that we can use to easily integrate our product into.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in terms of FDA compliance, automating inventory management has been a big topic in terms of defining how the software would need to work within compliance. And skipping just to one slide ahead here, there's a lot of consulting companies who specifically have cited automating inventory management as the best way to go about this. And in terms of understanding what those regulations are, we've done a lot of preliminary work in looking at the warning letters, essentially, that the FDA sends out to these companies, looking at the line items that they're given in terms of proper storage and warnings that they have to write back and show that they've fixed the problem, to see what we need to integrate into our software to be within those FDA sort of line items of, and those regulations.
Yeah, to provide for traceability.
Yeah.
The ultimate traceability. Okay.
Stuart?
Thank you. I think you guys picked the right spokesperson. But this idea of what do you own? You're using off-the-shelf imaging technology, right? So you're not developing that, correct?
Correct.
But you've developed software that's going to convert that image to a format, correct? And that's what you are really selling. Now tell me about your San Diego experience and why they love what you're doing. Here's a softball. Now hit it.
All right. So I went down to San Diego just to talk to a few of the biotechs there, and they suffer from a lot of these same problems. The reason being is that many of them are startups.
Yep.
And so they don't have the money to buy a $30,000 per year enterprise software from Fisher. And so this is something that everyone has a smartphone, everyone has a mobile device, and so if you can equip your scientists with something easy to use and has a really low learning curve, then they think it'll be far more effective. And so whether that's actually true, we still need to test, and we need to really make sure that they're using these features and they like them. But again, we need to develop the back end and the minimum viable product.
So Quartzy says that they're easy as 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
Are they? Are they not telling us the truth?
We call that a glorified spreadsheet. So in my experience working with Quartzy, it doesn't have any truly useful features beyond what you could do with a really well-designed spreadsheet.
And it's one thing to put data in. Do you have an elegant solution to get it out?
Yeah. So when you have most chemicals, they have an expiration date. You can look it up online on Google. So we can tabulate all of those, and then we can make it really easy, right? 6 months down the line, a box pops up and says, this reagent is expiring, and then you can easily remove it. We're trying to make it seamless.
Okay. Going back to a competitor, I mean, you don't have to teach a dog to eat a steak, right? And so if Quartzy realizes that using imaging is effective, can they add that to their system and not violate any of the intellectual property you're creating? Or what's the barrier to entry when they see that your system is intuitive, the dogs love the steak, and we're just going to copy you? How do you stop them?
Sure. So as we start to develop and work with companies, we're also collecting a lot of their use data, right? And so it's going to make it really hard to switch from our product to another product, because then you have to switch all of your data and all of your frequency of use data. And so we also keep that nice and protected for our companies.
But relying on first mover advantage and our brand really being about made by researchers for researchers and being first to the market on this and having that stickiness of the database.
Thank you.
We are out of time, but great job, Vanetta. And so we are going to start with our Impact Award, and I'm going to introduce Cheryl and John Gerngross because they sponsored this award.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Hello, everybody. It's really exciting to be here, and it's really stimulating to see all the brilliance in this room. We're really impressed with all the creativity and discipline and hard work that's gone behind all of these presentations, and it really gave us a lot to think about. Cheryl and I are sponsoring the Impact Award this year because we want to provide an incentive and a reward for students to create ventures that are for the public good. Profitability is not our primary goal or motive. We're not looking for the hockey stick growth charts. We're looking for helping the public good. It could be something environmental, it could be something social, but it does have to be a sustainable business model. So you gave us a lot to think about. We were debating this up to the last second, and I'll turn this over to Cheryl to give you the results.
Oh, the results. Okay. The results are, John and I were back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and I wanted this and he wanted that, but we decided to split it. And the split is more solar and Adomi. But wait 1 minute.
Times that we're going to do?
Okay. But really the reason why behind it is just there's only really two reasons why behind the impact. The more solar was really the environment issue and saving energy, and the other one was really to helping the housing market and people that can't afford homes.
Thank you so much.
All right, just warming up. My fellow workers reminded me of my Steve Harvey moment a couple years ago when I messed up, so I am intensely focused on this. Let's go now to the people's choice, and in keeping with well, let me first introduce Michael. Do you know who you're even saying?
What?
Okay, so we have two prizes for people's choice. There was a tie. So Michael Holland is a longtime entrepreneur who I think recently sold a company, and he was looking for ways to utilize his wisdom. And I know you were here last year because I saw pictures of you. And so we got him involved this year, and he's put so much effort into the teams and just such a great mentor and with a great heart and has been really impactful to the program, and he has sponsored the People's Choice Prize. So I'm going to let Michael keep it to 20 or 30 seconds and then, okay. Thank you.
This has been a great opportunity to get involved, and I'm certainly glad I don't have to make any choice. I'm presenting the People's Choice Awards and you all voted. So we have two winners. They split it. We have Soilite and Adomi. All right.
Pick one.
You can have both of them. All right. I knew we would do it. Hey, all right. Guys, you did it again.
We got both.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You guys, sharply. I was debating Brian.
That's a lot of money. Tightest business plan.
Good job. All right, cool.
You too. Oh.
149.
This is where Jason Stephen.
Okay, you know, every year I secretly hope for a six-way tie, and they let me down again. It was very difficult, though. That's why we took so long, so our apologies for how much time it took to sort all of this out. So we're going to start with the honorable mention category here in alphabetical order, so don't go trying to guess anything. And so the first honorable mention, and it's sponsored by Chase J.P. Morgan. Where are you? Come on up. Come on up, Rick. Who else is sponsoring this?
Cressa.
Cressa could not be here tonight, but Cressa Partners are a real estate firm down in the Valley. And so the winner, again, in alphabetical order, the first one is Okra. Russ, could you come up here quickly? Because I made a mistake. But at least I didn't mess up on the team. All right. So this actually is sponsored by Riker Fowl and Smart Office, but Smart Office could not be here. So here you go, guys. Oh, wait a minute. There you go. Rick is going to present that to you.
There you go. Thank you. Congratulations.
Get up there and take pictures. Oh, no. Sorry. Rick, I blew it. Get over here. Come on,
man. How about we all get in?
No. You stay right here with me. I'm suffering from a little lack of sleep. Okay, the next honorable mention winner, sponsored by Rick and Cressa, Soil Light. Okay, and the third honorable mention goes to Vanetta, and that's sponsored by Maps.com and MRL here at UCSB. Okay, and I'm sorry I keep interrupting with little tidbits, but after the New Venture Fair, I go table to table, and I try to explain to every team, the voting does not dictate whether or not you go forward. You do. Don't let somebody decide that for you. And so I was going to say that earlier. I need to say that now. So those of you that have an interest in continuing, you've made it this far. This is the first bump in your entrepreneurial journey. Don't let this stop you if your goal is to continue. Okay? So I always say it. I understand that's a hard thing to hear because this seems so validating. But just as it's not validating for the first place team always, it's also not validating for anybody else. So please keep that in mind because I would love to keep working with you. And now we have a facility to do it and some programming. So you're okay. So where are we? Where are we? All right. Third place, sponsored by Pay Junction and Procore. If you all would be ready. I'm avoiding. Okay, third place goes to Snip. That's a good idea. Okay, Mark, sponsoring second place, SoCal IP and Deloitte. Deloitte couldn't be here. And let's bring up the first place, too. Oh, come up. Okay, and Tal and Ian, come on up. So we'll do these sort of in succession, so we've already ruined the mystery here. Okay, so second place winner goes to Adomi, which makes first place more solo. Well, that will conclude it. By the way, everybody, we're going to hand out. Would you make sure they get the right speakers for everybody?
Yes.
Okay, before they go.
But before you guys go, I think we just need to give Dave one more round of applause for everything he's done this year. Big round of applause.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.